This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi for more information. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/sjcgi.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is also brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/PEL and enter promo code PEL. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 122 is something like, what's the relationship between psychology and metaphysics? We read St. Augustine's Confessions from around the year 400 AD, books 10 through 13, and we'll bring up some earlier parts again, as this is really a continuation of episode 121, where we read the rest of the book. You can join the discussion, find a link to the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer speaking to you from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
And where is Seth?
Where is Seth?
When is Seth?
Where, oh God, is Seth? He's in my memory.
But then he doesn't exist anymore. But I think the part that within him that is the truth is the common property of us all. So it is here among us.
And eternal.
Only he who speaks lies speaks from his own self. If you speak truth, you speak from God.
And therefore eternally.
Yeah.
Okay, we're done. We're done. Yeah. We're all set.
I think that's it.
So Seth would probably enjoy this conversation more than last time. By about a half hour in, he had gotten physically ill from the way things were going and how little he related to the text. Well, he was going to have a comeback this time to discuss that, but he didn't read the stuff in time.
Was it because of the book, or was it that he was just feeling ill separately?
I think it's Augustine's fault.
And our fault, apparently.
Insofar as we were speaking the boring, we were speaking from Augustine. Insofar as we were speaking the amusing, we were speaking from ourselves, to paraphrase. Perhaps we do need to bring ourselves back to our roots and read the ground rules for our discussion. Would that be absurd to do at this point?
No, I think it's the appropriate time.
All right. Number one, try not to assume that our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. Or Catholicism, or the Middle Ages, or has seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, or any of that. Number two, don't make arguments that hinge on something other than what we've agreed to read. Don't say, you would know what I was talking about if you'd read Thomas Aquinas's 12 Proofs That I Didn't Take Your Sandwich. And I have the 12 written out. Do you want to hear those?
You wrote out 12.
I wrote 12. They're very short. Number one, your sandwiches are gross. I wouldn't eat one of those if you paid me. Number two, the very idea. Number three, I only eat sandwiches on Thursdays and today is Friday. Number four, I didn't even know you had a sandwich. Number five, I'm allergic to bread. Number six, I'm allergic to theft. Number seven, I'm too clumsy to be so stealthy as to steal a sandwich. Number eight, the act of theft is too boring and common for me to pursue. Number nine, I don't even know what sandwiches are. Number 10, I don't even know what stealing is. Number 11, the sensory world is an illusion. Number 12, I was only borrowing it, not taking it.
So you're making fun of Thomas Aquinas on a St. Augustine podcast.
Foul!
Number three, we will be rigorous and exact in all that we say, unless doing otherwise would be potentially more entertaining.
Ah, the third rule comes to the rescue.
All right, this confessions, why we broke it where we did is because the part that we talked about last time was the biographical part. He talked a lot about sin on the way there. He would stop and reflect philosophically in almost every chapter, at least a little bit, but... here, now we're up to the present. He gets up to the point of his conversion in book 9, and then he just jumps forward 10 years to the present. He's confessing to God really what it is that he still doesn't know. He makes kind of a point about, well, what am I really doing here? I know I'm confessing to God, but God doesn't need to hear any of this stuff. God already knows everything. God doesn't need me. So what am I doing? Well, I'm doing this for myself to really get myself jazzed about the glory of God. I'm doing this to positively influence my fellow men who would read this, and he was a fairly big man in the church by the time this came out. And he actually ends up, in part of it, talking about hermeneutics. So just to cast back our eyes a few episodes ago when we were talking about interpretation of texts. I know he does this more directly in some other works, but he spends some time mostly in book 12 and some 13 talking about how to analyze the particular Bible verse in the beginning.
God created the heaven and the earth.
Yes. And then he goes on.
It's in the beginning, there was the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water.
Yes. So actually, by the end of 13, he's talked about all that stuff. He talks about God moving on the face of the water for quite a while and applying that to the present day. So that's how he ends this section that we read. How he kicks it off, though, we've got a whole big thing on memory, which is one of the most famous parts of the book. And then we've got another thing on time. So memory and time, and I want to talk a little about language acquisition, since that's another thing. One of the only things I knew about Augustine before reading this was that Wittgenstein uses him as the straw man at the beginning of the Philosophical Investigations as, here's a crappy way to think about language, that you just have thoughts in your head already when you're born, pretty much, and you're looking for words to attach them to. And so then somebody teaches you, points at things and says, oh, well, that's what that is. It's a eureka moment that you've hooked up those concepts that were already in your heads to words that other people use, and you learn a way to communicate. There's a little more to Augustine's view than that.
Yeah. In fact, his view seems a lot more like Wittgenstein's.
Yes.
Since it involves joint attention to objects and things like that.
So they seem to all mesh together pretty well to me. They're talking about, well, what is the mind? How do we know things? As I was joking about at the beginning of this, the way that we end up knowing things is really, we don't learn them from looking at stuff. We learn them from our own minds. And it's really God talking through our minds is how we end up learning anything. We don't really learn anything from anybody.
Oh, you're thinking of the...
That's addressed straight up in this other work, De Magistro, which I sent you guys around a 2-page summary of, but it made clear the way that he was using that in this book. There are plenty of places in this book where he says stuff that sound a heck of a lot like that.
Well, that was just for a priori principles, it seemed like to me. So for the obvious, the math stuff.
It seems to be multi-layered because he clearly talks about learning from the senses. And then he goes on to saying, well, there are certain things that I know and remember in my mind that are not of my senses, and goes on from there. But go ahead.
The important stuff, the philosophical stuff, is not anything that you could simply read. The way we kind of talked about him last time, God gave us the senses to learn with. Basically, God gave us a lot of gifts, but yet if you don't use them with God's name brand on them, if you don't use them while pursuing the God way, then you're using them wrong and they'll screw up. And that was the way we characterized it last time. And I think that is sort of fair, but to sort of make a little more sense of that, you could impose something maybe from more recent philosophy where it's not just, you know, if you're just paying attention to the senses, then you're going to be led astray all sorts of different ways. And it's only sort of when you are more philosophically reflective about the senses, which for Augustine means paying attention to this inner voice that ultimately comes from God, that comes from the truth, then you can make sense of all the crap that's going on outside of you. And by extension, you can even use those gifts we are given ethically.
Where are you taking this from?
I'm all over the place. These are the conclusions I've... I've reached from...
This comes from outside the reading.
From poring over the book here. From living in its fetid folds for a couple weeks. Okay, the last few days anyway. What other sort of introductory things before we dive in? I think we should spend a lot of time reading particular passages this time as opposed to maybe last time, since we have really less material to cover.
The only introductory thing I want to say was that everything after book 10 is fucking excruciating. Did everyone have that feeling, or was I just in a bad mood?
Did you feel that about the time stuff?
That in book 11?
Oh, no. The time stuff was interesting. Let's see.
Book 10 is mostly memory. Book 11 is mostly time. Book 12 is when he gets into the hermeneutics.
Yeah, the time is, yeah, I see with my notes I got into that. And then, so maybe I'm just thinking book 12.
Right. Book 12 is into hermeneutics, but it's also, since it's about this creation, then it also gets a little more into the metaphysics.
Oh, I'm thinking book 12. I meant book 12 and 13. Yeah, that's what I meant.
Book 13 is simply, yes, hard to get through.
Just the level of hysteria.
What was your impression, Dylan?
Well, maybe I saved myself because I really blasted through 12 and 13. But what I was most impressed by is, especially in the time section and in the memory section, but even in between there, you know, thinking about the senses, is his forthright phenomenological thinking and asking very obvious questions, trying to answer them and moving on to refine the question and unearth what he's thinking about and take seriously what was said either in the Bible or in the context of teachings about God to try to make sense of it. I found it pretty interesting as an example of fairly carefully thinking things through, regardless of where he completely ends up. It's thoughtful in an interesting way.
Thank you for balancing my negativity on that.
Well, by 13, he's kind of, in some ways, summing up. And I was hoping to, in this episode, test the challenge that I made of him last time, that because he's so introspective, he comes across real problems. So the problem, for instance, this time of, it seems like the past doesn't exist and only the present exists and it seems like the future doesn't exist. But then how could we measure time? And he's really spends quite a long time on that problem. But then it's with any of the problems, what I accused him of last time is that he ends up just kind of pulling a doctrinaire thing more or less out of his ass. Mm-hmm. It's not that that's something that in a Cartesian way became the conclusion he was dialectically driven to by this careful introspective consideration. It's just, this is really hard to understand is what he comes out of. And in fact says, oh God, please don't let me stop understanding now. I really want to know more. So I have these pauses where he entreats God to let him penetrate a little further into the mystery.
Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of God padding in these books.
Yeah.
And then he'll kind of wave his hand and give some empty doctrine.
Well, I didn't see him as being doctrinaire, actually. I didn't, but we can discuss the details of that when we...
An obvious example that I think is what Mark's talking about is the way in which is, well, of course, God is eternal.
Yes.
And therefore, once we get our head around that, then all the other following things fall into place about the way we need to understand X, Y, and Z. And maybe we'll get to a point where we can decide whether or not that seems doctrinaire or...
I thought he had an argument, which is that if you are going to explain all of creation, including spatiotemporality, those are things that are brought into being by another being, then that being has to stand out of space and time, and being outside of time, it follows that it's eternal.
Well, that's why the universe and time began at the same time, right? So that time didn't exist before the universe existed.
I mean, it's sort of a, I guess, a bald assertion to say there's no time before the beginning of the universe. I mean, I think we're amenable to it because it sort of squares, I think, with which most of us have learned about the Big Bang Theory, right?
Sure.
And the and also pronouncements and papers about physics about the sense in which time is an illusion or it's a dimension, and there might be universes. Well, I don't know. Now I'm talking out of my ass, but you know what I mean. So I think we're prepared to think in that way. But yeah, maybe for Augustine, I can't remember if he has a good reason for asserting that time and the universe begin together or...
Well, he plays around with the idea, which maybe is the Manichaean view, that time is just the movements of bodies.
Right.
So you could say a year is just the time it takes the earth to go around the sun. And that's what a year is. But then he says, no, clearly, if the earth just sped up, then it would be speeding up. It would go, whereas before it took one unit to get around, now it takes half a unit. But the fact that we could talk about units means that the time is an abstraction by which we measure movement. It is not the movement itself.
That whole section, which I think you characterized correctly, is an interesting misunderstanding of Aristotle about motion and about time. In the physics, Aristotle explains that time is the numbering of motion, so that motion is the fundamental thing, motion being just a general characterization of change, and that time is the numbering of that change. And in that case, you could be using whatever units you needed to use. And there might be the open question of whether there is a synchronization of all kinds of motion into one unit of measure, which would be time. Yes, if you picked one particular motion and then had a unit associated with it, you would, of course, need to rationalize time and be able to talk about how many seconds there are in the time it takes for you to walk from Sparta to Athens. It requires you to, you know, have a way of transforming that measure of time in a rational way. But it doesn't mean that the idea of numbering motion is not what time is about.
Well, the question is whether time, it's not just a matter of whether time is related to motion, but whether time is reducible to motion.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And that's why I found it an interesting seemed to be misunderstanding of Aristotle, because it seemed to be that it was really focused on particular motions, whether time is reducible to a particular motion, as opposed to motion in general, the numbering of motion.
I thought he addressed that, though.
Okay, well, maybe I missed it.
This is book 11, chapters 23 and 24.
Okay.
So chapter 23 is him rebutting this idea that time is simply the movement of the sun and other heavenly bodies. And then in chapter 24, it's motion of a body.
Right. I thought I gave the rebuttal in 23 already, that if the sun sped up, then we would know it sped up because time is prior. When we measure something, we are applying something prior, a standard to movement. We're not just looking at the movement. This was going back to the use of a priori concepts, which at the beginning, yeah, I was saying these are from God.
Well, we'd be comparing other movements, though.
So one of the things he says, you might think that it's a matter of comparing smaller movements to big movements, but think about if I'm comparing a long note to two short notes.
Yeah.
Well, then since they're not happening at the same time, I mean, they could. It could be that the long note is a G and the short note is a C, and I hear the C start and then stop, and the G keeps going. That way I can say one is longer than the other. That's one way, but that's not the way we measure. We measure by a pre-existent standard. So if we think that we're comparing things, you know, I look at one thing and I look at another, then it's comparable to my hearing the short note, hearing the long note, and then somehow being able to take my memory of the short note and map it onto the long note and say, well, that's three times as long or something. And he thinks there's something problematic about that.
Well, here's a paragraph right at the end of 24. Since the movement of a body is not the same as our measurement of how long the movement takes, which is what you were referring to, Mark, who can fail to see which of these is more deserving of the name of time? A body moves at different speeds and sometimes stands still, but time enables us to measure not only its motion, but its rest as well. And we say it was at rest for the length of time that it was in motion, or it was at rest twice or thrice as long as it was in motion, or any other proportion, whether precisely measured or roughly estimated. And to me, this epitomizes what I meant by a kind of funny mischaracterization of the notion of change, is that just because a particular thing was at rest doesn't mean that the numbering of motion doesn't apply to it. Maybe that's what he means as well, that by saying, therefore, time is not the movement of a body. And maybe, in fact, Augustine would agree more with the idea that time is a numbering of motion, but motion in the abstracted sense rather than motion of a particular body. But it seems like kind of a weak objection if he just means motion, that, oh, there's some things don't move, so therefore, how can you possibly be talking about numbering its motion?
I mean, the conclusion he reaches toward the end of book 11 is that measured time does not actually exist objectively, that it's a matter of our memory and our expectation.
Yep.
Talking about a long period of time in the past is talking about a long memory, and talking about a long time in the future is a long expectation, which is weird, like a long expectation that has something to do with my saying 4,000 years in the future, this will happen. Like, how can that correspond to something in my expectation? Like, I'm going to be dead. I expect to be dead way before then. So it does not correspond to a long expectation on my part, if expectation means anything like it does in my regular experience.
He does come in 26 when he asks the question, what do I measure time with? And he meditates on, do we measure a longer one by a shorter one as we measure a beam by in terms of cubits? Thus, we say that the duration of a long syllable is measured in the space of a short syllable and is said to be double. And then he talks about measuring poems. And by not all this do we arrive at an exact measure of time. It may well happen that a shorter line will take longer if it is recited slowly than a longer line hurried through. The same is true of a poem at a foot or a syllable. Thus, it seems to me that time is certainly extendedness, but I do not know what it is extendedness of, probably of the mind itself.
Yeah. So that's all he can say, is that it ends up being of the mind itself, because he can't say God is stretched through time, because that doesn't make any sense. God is eternal, is not stretched through time. So this comes back way at the end of chapter 13 or something. If God speaks to us, well, how could God do that? Because God is eternal, God exists outside of time. Well, but our minds would have to interpret, would have to hear, would have to see things as temporal. So it just ends up being, this is almost Kantian. This is the human mind is what adds time.
Right.
And it's interesting that even though we've got these objections here to, well, time is not equivalent to the motion of some bodies, some particular body, by the end of book book 12, chapter 9, nor was the creation of that formlessness, the invisible and formless earth, included in the numbering of the days. For where there is no form and no order, nothing comes and nothing passes away, and as a consequence, there are no days nor any changes to mark the duration of time. So that makes it sound like creation and time happened at the same time.
Yes.
It's happened at the same time, but he gets enough into, you know, what is this formless earth before God creates it, or where did he get the matter from to put it together? He addresses all those things about creation in great detail, and it sounds here like form, in other words, the principium individuationis, to pull in that term that he does not use, the division between things is required for there to be time.
Yeah, and so then it becomes either sounding very Aristotelian in the numbering of motion, that is, you have change, and therefore, along with change, you have time, and time doesn't exist without change. Or, as you were saying, it sounds Kantian in that it is the mind's experience of the world itself that numbers the world, and one way in which it does that is time.
For somebody who seems so enamored of Plato, he certainly doesn't talk about mathematics very much, does he?
Only a little bit in talking about numbers are an interesting example of memory for him. It's a lever for, in some ways, walking to God, that it gets you out of the senses. And then thinking about numbers, the numbers that we count with are different than the numbers we physically experience, like looking at two apples. When we start talking about numbers in general and counting with them, that's a lever into, I guess I would think of it as abstract thought, but it's of memories of things that aren't part of the senses.
Right. That's right after he talks about geometry.
Yeah.
The geometer's line is not the same as the line that we see, and no matter how straight an artist draws it.
The form of the circle versus the circle that you draw and stuff like that.
You know, what makes it sound modern and Kantian is by saying it's the mind, whereas Plato is going to say it's something objective. But as we were saying, for Augustine, those are the same things. The part of the mind that is the eternal part, the part of the mind that is the truth, the part of the mind that is real knowledge is God speaking through us.
Let's work up to that, right? He gets to that by thinking about memory. And he gets to thinking about memory by asking the question, what is God? In a funny way, he does a full circle. He asks, how do we come to know God? That's book 10, chapter 7. By what faculty does he come to know God? And then that leads him into analysis of memory.
Yeah, so it can't be the senses, obviously.
God is not found by whatever power it is that animates the body. He goes through this kind of Aristotelian de anima thing. Well, it can't be things that we have in common with animals. It's not that part of our soul that makes us move around, that even plants have that makes them grow. And it's not the sensory part of us. So it must be reason. It must be something the next level up.
So memory is going to actually be an important faculty for being in touch with God. It's part of why he's examining it here. In the same way, it's a way of being in touch with the a priori, or in Plato's parlance, recollection is the way you get in touch with the aide, which for Kant, or what Kant calls schema, the triangle that's standing for more than itself.
Chapter 7 here, he's got this storehouse model of memory, where memories are stored under general categories of the understanding. And in fact, he thinks we file things according to the senses by which they enter, and thinks he can prove that by the fact that, you know, it doesn't matter how loud things are. If I want to close my eyes and imagine a particular color or painting, that's not going to interfere. If I'm in a loud room and I try to imagine a sound, he thinks that I'm going to be distracted by the current sounds that are going on, but that the distraction would not cross senses that way. I'm not sure if that's true.
You're looking at the third paragraph of chapter 8 here. One thing we should note is that in the previous paragraph, just so we don't skip over that, we get a sort of representational model of perception and memory, so that, for instance, at the end of the second chapter, when we perceive something, it's not that the things themselves come into us and sort of stay in that storehouse. We have images of the things.
Right.
But that's the a priori stuff. There's no distinction between the thing itself and the image. So if it's principles of mathematics, it's not like there's any distinction there. But we get to that later. But for this no cross-interference part, Mark, I thought he was talking about common sense here. The sense in which we're coordinating all the different senses into an experience of one object.
Can we get a quote?
So this is the third paragraph of chapter 8 of book 10. And even though we know by which senses they were brought in and laid up in the memory, who can tell how these images were formed? Even when I'm in darkness and in silence, if I can, I will produce colors in my memory and distinguish black from white, and in any other colors if I choose, and sounds do not break in and disturb the image I am considering that came in through the eye, since the sounds themselves were already there and lie stored up apart. For I can summon them too, if I like, and they are immediately present. And though my tongue is at rest and blah, blah, blah. He's talking about the fact that we can recall, obviously, we can bring these experiences to mind even when we close off the senses. We can use memory to sort of have a quasi experience of things. Mark, you were getting at this lack of cross interference between them.
Right. Well, it's supposed to come from a very literalistic picture of, like you said, the images of things are coming in our heads. And we can then pull them up later as if a storehouse. I feel like Wittgenstein here saying Augustine is giving a classical view that was later proven wrong by scientists and folks like that.
Wait, what part is proven wrong? That we don't have
just
mental images?
The idea that we have, that what memory primarily is a storehouse of actual images. And he seems to think that those aren't lost, that if you forget, well, where did it go? It's still down in there. It's just you somehow can't call it to consciousness. He doesn't have the terms consciousness and unconscious there, but he's groping toward that. And that goes with the idea that if it comes in as an audible thing, then you store it as an audible thing. If it comes in as a visual thing, you store it as a visible thing. Whereas I think it's been shown by psychological experiments that we kind of jumble all those things together. And the thing that gets stored is some kind of composite that we put together that then we might forget particular details or even forget what modality we learned it by.
Yeah, I don't know the neuroscientific answer to that now.
I'm not going to try to actually say what the right answer is. It's different than this warehouse theory.
Yeah, I'm not familiar enough with that too. But I thought Wittgenstein's point was it's not when you have a concept of something, it's about what significance means. Significance isn't imagistic. The concept isn't imagistic. But Plato's already onto that with his eidos because it's a non-visible visible, right? So is Augustine and Kant with his schema and Augustine with his version of that. That's the whole point of saying that, well, when I draw this triangle, that schema, it's not actually this particular triangle that is the point. It just stands in as a sort of intermediary. So for instance, even if in saying the word dog, you might imagine a dog, a particular dog, but what it's doing schematically there, even if you've given it black fur, the color of its fur, of course, is irrelevant to its being a dog. And you can make lots of variations in those different appearances in the same way you can adjust the sides of the triangle in your head, but it doesn't matter. It still represents all triangles. What we got from the Wittgenstein episode is this emphasis on the fact that we're not thinking in images. The way I think about this is a concept is about potentiality. It's about all those different places you could go, either by imagining a particular or in being able to recognize a particular when you come into contact with them. So it's about potentiality in that sense. When we run through a bunch of sentences as we're talking, it's not like we're just getting this succession of little images. Most of those words are significant without ever registering in our minds consciously with a schema or an image or anything like that. I didn't know if, Mark, if that's what you were trying to relate that to in Wittgenstein or not.
I was making just a more abstract point about Wittgenstein accusing Augustine of being naive. I was doing basically the same thing with regard to memory, but there are certainly interesting points of comparison between the warehouse imagistic theory of memory and a theory of concepts. But he doesn't actually make that connection here that I saw too much. Apparently there's another book, De Doctrina Christiana, on Christian doctrine, where he actually has a theory of signs, but we didn't read it, so I'm not going to guess.
Okay.
I was going to ask if everything you were saying Augustine said, or if you were...
So I was saying that there's actually more compatibility between all these thinkers. So with the whole idea of what a concept is, I actually...
Yeah.
I'm not so sure that Wittgenstein and Kant and Augustine are as inconsistent. I may just misunderstand that. I guess Mark was actually at a different criticism, just this whole idea of the memory storehouse.
It seems to me that Plato and Augustine, and maybe most of them, are keying off phenomena like, I can recognize a dog as a dog and never having seen that particular dog. And I recognize a tree as a tree. I've never seen that particular tree. And they all see some activity of memory going on in there. And then there might be slightly varying accounts of exactly how that's working, whether it's imagistic or not. But they seem to all run afoul of it being merely imagistic and kind of a very simple-minded filing system in our memory that amounts to matching, because they all recognize that you can't have all the matches in your mind. None of them go so far as to say, a priori, even in the notion of recollection, the myth of recollection in Socrates, that I have a exact image of everything in my mind that ever possibly existed. And my process of engaging with the right. world is matching up those files of images with the world that I experience. Even if it's imagistic, they don't go that far. There has to be a way right. in which you cross over and are able to account for all the variety of experienced images with a much smaller set of them.
Right. One thing we should be clear about here is right now we're talking about memories of particular experiences, and then we're also segueing into our use of concepts, which obviously involves memory. So we don't want to mix those two things up, and they're related, of course. One way to distinguish Plato and Wittgenstein is here we're talking about concepts, and so for Plato, the grasping of a particular involves a recollection directed towards what we would think of as a concept, but would he would call an idea in its own sort of metaphysical realm. And so he calls that anamnesis or recollection. And there's a sort of rational, intuitive contact with that. And that's what grounds our use of the concept. For Wittgenstein, I think he would deny that, and he would certainly deny the metaphysics of that. Although at some cognitive psychology level, there's got to be something similar when we talk again of these use of schema and things like that. So there could still be something going on neuroscientifically or the way we would describe it through cognitive psychology, that it would actually look quite a bit like Plato, but without the metaphysics. But they're still obviously, of course, distinct.
Would you agree Augustine is a little closer to Plato in this
yeah.
recollection business?
Because I think God is going to serve that grounding role that the ideas do for Plato.
And they both have the same sort of answer to the problem of learning. That is, neither of them want to say that you actually create something necessarily. In answering the question, well, how do I recognize something if I had never seen it before? How do I learn something that I never actually encountered before? And their answer to that has to do with, well, I must have within me all of those things that allow me to recognize them in particular, and therefore I recollect them. And for Plato, then, like in the Meno, the process of learning is one of re-remembering, of recollecting, of the things that I had forgotten.
So it's interesting to connect Augustine's account of everyday memory, we might say, with this notion of this Platonic collective unconscious sort of memory. Given that ultimately learning things, as you were saying, is being hooked up to this collective unconscious to God, there actually is nothing that would prevent him from having a theory by which all knowledge is somehow internal, that we don't learn anything from the outside world at all. That if you don't have a weird metaphysics like that, then you end up saying, how could the brain possibly hold infinitely many potential images? But at least this is at his disposal, that Augustine yeah. could say that.
Yeah, we should make sure we're clear about that distinction. So the anamnesis theory is about learning math and first principles and general concepts of things. It's about having those things within you. Although in the Parmenides, the young Socrates is challenged, well, is there an eidos of mud? Getting at that, well, something so formless, how could there be a priori an eidos for that?
It's as if you're remembering a future episode.
Sorry, Socrates says, yes, there is. So, you know, that still is a problem. That's a whole different thing than saying that we have all our particular experiences somehow in us to begin with, that our actual sensory experience is recollection. That would be a different proposition.
Not to stay too much longer on Plato, interpreting the myth of recollection in the Meno, it seems to me that you could easily understand it as a myth. And the point of that myth is to try to rationalize how out of ourselves we're able to understand new things, taking at face value that those things must be in us, at least the power of that must be in us. Maybe there's other parts of the myth and other parts of Plato that make it much more concrete than that.
Well, this is very much making me want to segue to talk about language from earlier in the book. But before we do that, let's talk about our sponsor, the St. John's College Graduate Institute.
The Graduate Institute is a master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. If you want to have thoughtful conversations like the kind of conversations we have on this podcast, it's a great place for you to go. It's not like any other graduate school you've heard of. You can actually visit if you like and experience a seminar. It's a seminar in which the professor, and we call them tutors at St. John's, is behind the scenes, and the students take control of the conversation. and they're reading great books, primary sources. So it's not lectures, and it's not the kind of graduate seminar you would get in many other programs.
In addition to the Graduate Institute, which is a great place for either full-time engagement in a regular semester-to-semester schedule for 2 years, or you can do it over a series of summers, over an intense 8-week program. You can also get a little bite of it going to any of the summer programs that the Graduate Institute helps sponsor as well. The Summer Classics Program, the Film Institute, and the Greek Study Program, that for a shorter amount of time allow you to participate in seminars and see a bit more of what it's like and help you decide whether the Graduate Institute is exactly what you want to be doing. The Graduate Institute has both a liberal arts program that's based upon the Western classics, but also an Eastern classics program.
So the Graduate Institute is currently accepting applications. They accept them on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. If you're a PEL citizen, a fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in the serious contemplation of the great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
This episode is also brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost.
Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the customer. Casper's mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress at a very fair price. I've used one, and just talk about the...
Yeah, I actually have one now as of the last month, and it's pretty awesome. It's, I was used to the bouncy spring kind. This combines latex and memory foam. So it's a little funny that you sit on it and it doesn't spring back up. But on the other hand, it actually just provides a heap of support and it's super comfortable. It came in a big box, like compressed, where you open the box and you cut it open and it springs out and becomes this giant thing. So you buy them easily online. It's a way better deal than getting it at a mattress store. I was looking at Sears or something and was seeing, I don't know exactly how comparable, but I mean, in the really, really high.
Yeah, they're ridiculously expensive. I think for a memory foam mattress, you can spend thousands of dollars if you're getting one of the big brands. But Casper is much, much more affordable than that.
Yeah, so it's $500 for a twin or $950 for a king size mattress. It's an outstanding price point compared to industry averages.
And they have a 100-day return period, so you can try it to your heart's content and send it back for a full refund if you don't like it.
Right. It might seem like, don't you want to just lie on something in a showroom, but it's that actually doesn't tell you anything. Statistically, lying a bed in a showroom has no correlation to whether it is the right bed for you.
You need at least 89 days, and then you can make your decision.
Okay, so I haven't quite done that yet, but I'm getting there. You can save an additional $50 as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/PEL. Entering the promo code PEL. That's casper.com/PEL, promo code PEL, for better nights and brighter days. All right, so we were just discussing Augustine's Platonic tendencies. Well, this is making me want to at least pull in since there's not actually that much text to pull in, the earlier stuff on learning language, because that's very much essential. Okay, so of course Augustine doesn't think that nothing comes through the senses. He's not a complete rationalist. But his account that I characterize, let's try to read, this is book 1, chapter 8, where he's talking about himself as an infant. And of course he doesn't remember this. He says, I did not learn by elders teaching me words in any systematic way, as I was soon after taught to read and write, but of my own motion, using the mind which you, my God, gave me. I strove with cries and various sounds and much moving of my limbs to utter the feelings of my heart, all this in order to get my own way. Now I did not always manage to express the right meanings to the right people, so I began to reflect. I observed that my elders would make some particular sound, and as they made it, they would point at or move towards some particular thing, and from this I came to realize that the thing was called by the sound they made when they wished to draw my attention to it. That they intended this was clear from the motions of their body. By a kind of natural language common to all races, which consists in facial expressions, glances of the eye, gestures, and the tones by which the voice expresses the mind's state. For example, when things are to be sought, kept, thrown away, or avoided. So as soon as I heard the same words again and again properly used in different phrases, I came gradually to grasp what things they signified, and forcing my mouth to the same sounds, I began to use them to express my own wishes. Thus I learnt to convey what I meant to those about me. and so took another long step along the stormy way of human life and society.
So that is a completely Wittgensteinian picture of language acquisition. It's quite accurate, I think. I've talked about this guy before, Michael Tomasello, a book called The Origins of Human Communication and several other books. And by the way, he considers himself a sort of a Wittgensteinian linguist, and he's done a lot on language acquisition in primates and human beings. And this idea of pointing at things is essential. This joint attention that you give to objects that precedes language is really the foundation of language. And there's something linguistic, because a lot of primates or other animals, they can't really understand pointing in the sense that they can't look at a gesture and then read your mind and read your intentions, saying, that's interesting to me, and it is also should be interesting to you, which is the whole sort of communication in pointing. So I was pretty startled by this passage when he talked about this idea, pointing at some particular thing and gestures and glances of the eye. That's why earlier I said I didn't really understand why Wittgenstein used him as a foil.
Well, just from the element that I had thoughts in the first place, and I was just looking for ways to express them, and I couldn't figure out any way, so I just flailed around and screamed.
Well, he doesn't say thoughts. He says the feelings of his heart.
The feelings of my heart.
There's an argument to be made that you can't turn feelings into thoughts without concepts and without language, although I'm not so sure.
Does that help or does that hinder, or is it irrelevant to the question of the extent to which Augustine is an a priorist about knowledge in general? It seems there's a lot that's come in a priori, but the only thing it seems that he learned from the outside was the actual words and that the words go with those things. Now, the distinguishing this from that, to know that you were pointing at this thing and not something else, the understanding what pointing is in the first place, the understanding that words can stand for things, these seem to be all things that he came up with on his own through divine guidance.
Wittgenstein's objection is that you learn language as people putting little labels on things for you. And that's the point of the whole Wittgenstein construction scene, because it's about other people's intentions, it's about your intentions and getting them to do things. It's about that whole game, right? Which most of this passage seemed entirely consistent with that. Is there a place where it sounds like people are just helping him label things? So it's a subtle kind of distinction, right?
Well, I guess it just depends on how you interpret the stuff we were reading earlier from the analysis of memory and the file system labeling memories based upon their primary sense experience and so forth. I think that he gets past that maybe to something that's more consistent with what Mark just read on how we learn. In that section, he's clearly learning through a variety of sense impressions, and his learning requires that there be a kind of lining up of multiple ones of them. The pointing with the sight, with the sound, with all of that's going into him learning language. So the language itself is a kind of node of different sense experiences coming together to give you language that you work with.
Yeah, I don't think there's anyone who would deny that we need sense experience to learn language. Obviously, there's a linguistic debate, I think it's still ongoing, about the extent to which the fundamental structure of language or the rules of language are innate and a priori, that they just come as part of the evolutionary structure of the brain. And so, of course, Noam Chomsky is on the sort of Platonist side of that debate. It's a question of degree. Obviously, the cognitive apparatus is there in human beings in a way that it isn't in other animals. You know, and then there's that very fine question of to what extent is this stuff innate and to what extent do we acquire it by experience? Very clearly, we have to have some experiences to acquire it. And also very clearly, there's something innate, even if it's just the most bare bones of capacities.
Yeah, I mean, that gets back to your comments about potential, right? If what you mean by innate is that you have all of these memories whole cloth and all of these experiences whole cloth that just are kind of pulled out of you as a result of experience, that sounds like an absurd conclusion. On the other hand, if you say, oh, you're going to learn it all, then it seems you have to have the potential to learn it. So there has to be something there that is acted upon and acting upon the world in order to generate the activity of the mind. As you said, there's something innate has to be going on, even if it's not the particular memories and images and so forth.
And that's what I'm wondering about, you know, when he's talking about the warehouse, that we who think that tabula rasa makes sense. When I was in school and I learned about Locke's tabula rasa, we're born blank and then experience writes on it. That seemed completely intuitive to me. And so it's sort of been a struggle since then to get a hold of that. Oh, no, there's what about Chomsky's? Yeah, the structures of language are already, you know, there's a lot of stuff that instinct gives us. And we have to talk about the difference between knowing that and knowing how and all this kind of stuff. I don't think that Augustine had that concept at his disposal. So when he says a warehouse, we might picture, well, when you're born, the warehouse is empty. And then as the senses bring stuff in, and then it files all the stuff from sight here and all the stuff from hearing there. The way he makes use of the warehouse is we catch it in media res with it already stuffed full of stuff. The phenomenology of it is that we could have seen something and then we forget it, but then we recall it again by its connection to something else. Well, where could it have been? It must have been lurking back in the warehouse somewhere. So it's like the warehouse is a big, indefinitely large thing already filled with crap that's really dark everywhere except 3 feet in front of us, which is very different than tabula rasa. We fill it up and we empty it out or something.
I'm a little confused now, because even a rationalist or even someone with a Platonic theory of recollection, those are for concepts or for a day. And particular experiences still have to come in through the senses. It's just that the experience is theory laden, let's say, or it's concept laden. It doesn't become experience until, say, for Kant, what our mind does to the raw data, to the raw given. Although for Kant, that's kind of a mystery what that is, because for it to be an experience, you already have to have done so much to it. But there still has to be a given. There still has to be data coming in from the outside, no matter how hyper-rationalist and how Platonic or Kantian you are. There's still a flux. So the storehouse theory is about, the theory he's starting with here is a theory about storing up memories, that particular memories that we acquire. Just a few sections down, we're going to start getting into the a priori stuff. But the a priori stuff is really quite different, because that's where the thing itself and the image are the same thing. Here, they're just images of the outside world in this storehouse. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, and he gets to that transition where he comes to the conclusion that the mind is not large enough to contain itself. So he says in just the last paragraph, "Great is this power of memory, exceedingly great, O my God, a spreading limitless room within me. Who can reach its uttermost depth? Yet it is a faculty of my soul and belongs to my nature. In fact, I cannot totally grasp all that I am. Thus the mind is not large enough to contain itself. But where can that part of it be which it does not contain? Is it outside itself and not within? How can it not contain itself? How can it be that any of itself that it is not is in itself?" So I think it's by this kind of question that he gets to the stuff that, Wes, you're pointing to, that question of concepts, and that there has to be that kind of connectedness, that the mind has access to something that is more than itself.
Before, actually in the paragraph before that, he's also talking about the role of memory in self-consciousness, in imagination, and in will. So he's really talking about something much bigger, and he's sort of telling us that it's, memory is sort of this foundation for mental faculties in general and the things we can do with the mind. But yeah, I think you're right, Dylan, this transition at the end about the vastness within and the sense in which it's unexplained, the sense in which we could be a mystery to ourselves, or that the mind is not large enough to contain itself, gets us to this point where there's going to be to our relationship to the a priori and ultimately to God.
So that would be in
9.
9 and 10.
Well, that's where he uses this cabinet image.
So this is where I started to first see this a priori stuff, the very beginning of 9, where he says, "These are not the only thoughts to which the immense capaciousness of memory gives rise. In memory also are all such things as we have learned of the liberal sciences and have not forgotten, lying there as if in a more inward place, which yet is no place. And of these things I have not the images, but the things themselves." So principles, I think, and he talks about grammar, and, you know, I guess we can think also of scientific principles, anything to do with our general knowledge instead, not just particular experiences.
Yeah, and continuing in 10, "Now when I hear that there are three kinds of questions, whether a thing is, what it is, and of what sort it is, I do indeed retain the images of the sounds of which those words are composed, and I know that they pass through the air with a certain noise and now no longer are. But the things themselves which the sounds signified, I could not come at by any bodily sense, nor see them at all save by my mind. And what I stored in my memory was not their images, but the truths themselves.
So this is something we could think about phenomenologically, where our experience of objects is actually perspectival, and it's a series of experiences with different senses, and that the thing itself, the object as a whole, is not something that comes in through any one sense. It has to be constructed of all those individual experiences.
On the one hand, he recognizes them as being part of his memory, but he pleads confusion about how they got into his memory, at least in this part. I think Mark's right. In the end, it's going to be by God.
And we can relate this. So, for instance, he says right after that, "For I run my mind over all the doorways of my body, but I cannot find any door by which they could have come in."
Yeah.
So it reminded me here of Humean skepticism about causality and the sense in which there's no sensory doorway for that, for causality in particular. That's also related.
Or perhaps he was just too priggish to consider all the possible doorways.
Jesus Christ.
Yes. The
anal theory of perception. Is that what you're going to say?
Yes. I was trying to figure out, how to get there. But
just leave it to Mark. Russ, he's an expert.
It was already there in my memory. And
the common bad taste of men. Collective unconscious.
So at the end of this, he gets to the recollection. Thus, they must have been in my mind even before I learned them, though they were not in my memory.
And he, in the next couple sections, moves on into that, just doubling down that memory is not senses in chapter 12. This is where he further makes the transition to the abstract and the a priori. The memory also contains the innumerable principles and laws of numbers and dimensions, and none of these have been impressed upon it by any bodily sense, seeing that they have neither color, nor sound, nor scent, nor taste, nor feel. To know them is to recognize them interiorly without any concept of any kind of body whatsoever. With all my bodily senses, I have perceived the numbers that we use in counting, but the basic numbers by which we count are not the same as these, nor images of these, but really are. Let whoever does not see these truths laugh at me for talking thus. While he laughs at me, I shall be sorry for him.
I love that line. I put a little star next to that. That was awesome. He's feeling a little insecure about his theory here.
Well, yeah, but importantly, numbers are examples of things that really are. Again, he's sounding very Platonistic here, right?
Yeah.
That the mathematics is the truth in the same way that forms are. I was wondering if you guys saw stuff about falseness and mistake. In chapter 13, I thought he was going to start talking about how we're wrong about things and where we have false notions. And he seems to acknowledge there and in a couple other sections that we can hold things to be true in our mind and have them actually be false. But he doesn't seem to me to get very far in articulating how to distinguish them. And that is how to know when we're wrong.
Right. Because it seems like anybody who would be reminding us of one of these general truths, in other words, you hear a bit of philosophy or anything in the liberal arts from somebody, and then for it to get in your mind, it's not just that somebody tells you some information and you put that together in some way from, even if the meanings themselves are pre-existent in your head, you can construct the doctrine. It sounds like the way he had presented, the way we've been reading it, that all such things just jump full-blown from the recesses of the collective unconscious of the Platonic formland where they were hidden. But then it seems like you couldn't hold any general propositions that were not in fact true. But since that's wrong, you have to somehow revise the theory.
Is he trying to explain that here? I thought these sections he's getting into now are sort of paradoxes of memory, where it's true that I remember thinking that the Eiffel Tower was in London, even though it's false that the Eiffel Tower is in London. The sort of indirect problems of error that we saw in the Theaetetus, and also with Russell, and the sort of indirect reference, Russell and Frege and all the rest of it, it's really central, the sense in which you can logically allow error. And so in section 14, he does it with feeling. You know, I could joyously remember sorrow, where I can recall having emotions without being actually disturbed by the emotions.
Yep.
And later on, remembering forgetfulness.
Let's talk about that emotion thing a little bit. Earlier he had said, when we were talking about the imagistic stuff, it's not necessarily clear that he thinks that to think is to have images, but he definitely thinks that when you think there are images that accompany that. And I'm trying to find a quote here. Book 10, section 8, verse 14 here. In my memory, too, I meet myself. I recall myself, what I have done, when and where, and what state of mind I was when I did it. In my memory are all the things I remember to have experienced myself or have to have been told by others. From the same store, I can weave into the past endless new likenesses of things, either experienced by me or believed on the strength of things experienced. And from these, again, I can picture actions and events and hopes in the future, and upon them, I can meditate as if they were present. I shall do this or that, I say to myself in the vast recess of my mind, with its immeasurable store of images of things so great, and this or that follows. Oh, if only I could be this or that, or again, may God prevent this or that. Such things I say within myself, and when I speak of them, the images of all the things I mention are to hand from the same storehouse of memory. And if the images were not there, I could not so much as speak of the things. That's what I was trying to get at.
So he's talking about the imagination here, and it's a very Humean-sounding thing, where I can come up with new things by recombining different experiences. And then that's required for the will. Obviously, being able to imagine a future is part of a requirement for the will. So,
but it was the image-making part that I was focusing on. So yes, when I think anything, in order to understand what I'm thinking at all, some sort of visual image comes to mind. Does that sound correct?
I don't know that that's true.
Certainly if I'm thinking about the future or the past, then some visual images comes to mind.
But he's talking about thinking of particular things, you know, especially with regards to the will. When I'm going to be this or that, or what I'm going to do, what the future holds. Those are particular.
Right. So particulars are stored and called back up and as particular. So when I think of my mother, a particular image from my memory somewhere of my mother comes up. It's not just that there's an amalgam that all these things get sort of smashed together and maybe even connected with other things that were associated with my mother. So the mother and the black bear are thought of in the same, all these Freudian weirdness of the subconscious mashing things together. None of that's happening. It's just that there's a storehouse of immaculate images that I draw one back. And that's how is essential for language to work.
Well, they're not necessarily immaculate. He talks about the different gradations of clarity and distinctness and very early on. But this is why I wanted to keep these two ideas of recollection very distinct. It's recollections of the images that have been stored up as opposed to a more Platonic theory of recollection associated with the a priori. Those are two very distinct things.
Right. The initial way he makes the distinction is not by saying experience versus a priori. He doesn't talk that way really at all, but he talks about sensory things and things from the liberal arts, right?
The key distinction is these are images, and with the liberal arts, it's the things themselves.
Yes. And so when we get to feelings, that's the part that it seems difficult, that with the liberal arts, it's the things themselves that come in our heads, because we're talking about ideas. Whereas with the sense impressions, of course, it's not the things themselves, it's the images of them. But what about a pain? You know, I had a pain before. Well, I guess I have a memory, an image of the bodily pain. So he considers bodily pains first. And we can sort of think about how the image of the bodily pain is like the image of red in general or something. I don't have to have a reddish mood come on me just by thinking about the term red.
I think Augustine requires that we think of image more generally than visual, but as instances of any kind of sense perception individually.
Yeah, say impressions. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sense impressions. So that, you know, when I think of a song, I'm not necessarily thinking in visual imagery. I may be thinking in terms of sense impressions.
Although he points out that you can say, see how that song goes? That really all the different senses get sort of swept up in the way we talk about it in terms of sight.
He's just saying that's that just vision an is a metaphor thinking. For thinking. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the problem with feelings is that it seems like the feeling, if it's a mental feeling.
Well, it's the paradox of being able to have a memory of a feeling without actually having the feeling.
Yes.
So the premise in that is, yes, this happens all the time, is I remember being upset, but I'm not now upset.
I remember being happy and I'm depressed.
In fact, I'm depressed because I remember being happy.
It's even worse.
Or I remember fear without being afraid, where I thought he stated that a little too strongly. Like, that's one of those kind of Freudian.
It's certainly not always the case, right? That she could remember feeling sad and become sad. Yeah.
Yes, yes. That thinking about the past sorrow makes you, yeah.
But not always. And, you know, as we just pointed out, you might actually feel depressed thinking about past joys because of your distance from them.
Just depends on how zen you are.
Isn't it that I remember that I was sad, but I don't remember the sadness without actually feeling the sadness?
That's a good question. Have I really remembered my sadness until I've felt the sadness that I'm remembering?
How do I know?
I'm remembering it through an opaque glass, but yeah.
I think it is similar to a smell, that he thinks that for any of the sensory things, you could remember an image of the smell. But can you really remember an image of a smell? Or is it just that I remember that that was a bad smell, but then until you smell it again, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe how bad that I didn't remember it being that bad or something.
My wife used to get really annoyed at me when I would order food at a restaurant because I would look at the menu and I would start imagining eating the food and tasting what it must taste like. And so I'd be like moving my mouth around and just try. And what I was clearly doing is trying to bring forth the taste sense of that food and what it must be like in order to make that decision. And it's not the same as, oh, I remember what a hamburger tastes like, but the recollection of the hamburger involved invoking the sensation of the taste of the hamburger. It seems to me there's something right about the idea that when we recollect things that are associated with sensory perceptions, it's one thing to remember the instance of it and be able to point to it like the way you would point to a painting or a category of something. But to actually have remembrance of the sense itself would involve invoking the shadow of that sense as experienced, activating it in some way.
So he denies that.
And he says does. It
makes perfect sense that we can remember this. So what does he make out of that? This is supposed to cause a problem.
No, I think Dylan was saying something consistent with Augustine, wasn't he? The same sort of thing where you can remember it.
I think there's two ways to remember it, right? Is that you can, and Augustine points to this as being the confusion. Uh-huh. You can remember being sad while you were happy and not have it make you sad. And we were pointing out, and I don't think Augustine emphasizes this, but of course that you could also remember being sad and you might actually experience the feeling of sadness in doing that. And we were asking the question, isn't there something more authentic about that being the memory of the sadness rather than it being a pointing to the memory of the sadness? And that there might be a distinction that is worth making between those two things. Augustine emphasizes the first.
Right. Both are consistent with him. I think he knows that, you know, that having an emotion could trigger that emotion. It's just that in many cases it doesn't. And in many cases it's sort of somewhere in between, right? The sadness that I feel about my past sadness is not exactly the same sadness, if that's what I'm going through. It's not the sadness that I felt then. In the same way, you know, I can't perfectly photographically remember the movie theater I was just in or something like that. It still counts as memory. It's more conceptual, right? You know, if I remember being sad, but I don't have the feeling re-evoked, I still understand what sadness is. And I could abstractly remember my sadness without feeling it.
I mean, the classic examples is people saying, well, the only reason why there are any human beings in the world is that women don't remember the process of giving birth.
Right.
Now, that might not be completely true. It might be that even when people have a very clear memory of the ordeal they went through, they're still willing to do it again, be it childbirth or be it other things. That they go back for it because there's something else in it. It's not for lack of remembering the actual ordeal and the pain of it that prevents them from going back to it.
So the image he uses to talk about remembering things without re-feeling them is the memory is the belly of the mind, is the mind's stomach. And joy is like food that sits in the belly but cannot be tasted.
He just has such an evocative way of writing. Perhaps one might say that the memory is like the mind's stomach. And joy and sorrow like nice or nasty food. When joy and sorrow are committed to the memory, it is as though they had passed into the stomach where they can lie but not be tasted. It is, of course, ridiculous to see it like this, but yet some sort of resemblance there is.
Well, and then next he talks about, perhaps, therefore, just as food is brought up from the stomach by chewing the cud, So things are brought up from the memory by remembering. But if this is so, why is it not the pleasure of the joy or the pain of the sorrow felt in the mouth of his thinking by the man who thus remembers them? Nobody would want to talk about sorrow or fear,
right?
If we felt them every time we...
But as Wes pointed out, I think that he sees that the two things we're talking about, that it's possible, of course, to feel the fear when you were talking about it. But what's interesting to him is that you can talk about the fear without feeling it.
Right.
The whole point of this is he presents it as a paradox. Yet we could not speak of them, like fear and pain, unless we found in our memory not only the sound of their names according to the images impressed upon it by the sense of the body, but also the notions of the things themselves, which notions we did not receive by any gate of the body. It was the mind, aware of them through the experience of its own passions, which committed them to the memory, or as often happens, the memory of itself retained them, although the mind did not commit them to it.
Yeah, again, this is another angle into the activity of the mind not merely being an activity or conglomeration of senses.
The particulars come in through the senses, but the concepts associated with them are a priori, are there in the mind to begin with.
Yeah. And while he, in the next section, acknowledges there being some uncertainty about whether this is all made up of images or not of images, he's pointing out that there's a kind of paradox or confusion here.
Well, he gets on into the next section in section 15. The sense in which memory is required for signification, right?
Yep.
We talk about objects and their absence when we use symbols and language. And so, unless there was some image of it in my memory, I could not possibly recall what the sound of the name signified.
And then he's moving toward
math,
the remembering of forgetfulness. So, the remembering of the negative.
Yeah.
I can also name forgetfulness and know what I mean by the word, but how should I recognize the thing itself unless I remembered it? I'm not speaking of the sound of the word, but of the thing the sound signifies.
That's straight out of Meno, right?
Meno's paradox in reverse, actually.
In reverse?
Well, yeah, because in Meno, the question is how you could investigate something without already knowing it to some extent, right? Because you wouldn't know it if you found it unless you already somehow knew it. Here, it's how can I say I've forgotten something?
If I didn't already know it.
Yeah. Or if I didn't in some sense know it, yeah. Does anyone have an example or something to make that less confusing?
This is what was confusing about this is if saying you remember forgetfulness, I'm not sure he's saying, I remember that I forgot the name of that guy. It's not a particular thing because it's not that puzzling to say, well, I remember that guy. I remember his face. I remember that people have names.
Right.
But I just don't remember the name of that guy. Like, there's just nothing problematic on his theory of why that particular name should have slipped my mind. It's the concept of forgetfulness as a whole. He thinks that that involves remembering the negative in an important way. And I'm trying to understand why that would be so puzzling, because it seems in the kind of the same way, well, I remember certain instances of when there was something that I didn't remember, when I was lacking some piece of information. I remember a time where I didn't remember somebody's name. It doesn't seem that hard to just say forgetfulness is an abstract notion. It is not something that stands for a thing itself. This is my problem, and why I feel like, Wes, you're a little too quick to attribute to Augustine more sophisticated concepts than he has at his disposal, like the notion of a concept and how the notion of a concept is distinct from individual things. And, you know, by the time we get to Wittgenstein, we say, of course, individual things maybe have images associated with them, but concepts don't have images associated with them. Or if they do, they're kind of irrelevant to what the concept actually is. That I feel like Augustine has a very literal imagistic notion of concept as well. And so that's why this is having a problem.
Except that he doesn't use the word concept, but he does make this distinction between having the things themselves, the a priori things themselves in the memory, and having particular images of particulars. So that's straight out of Augustine. That's not my...
And for Augustine, it becomes him distinguishing mind from memory.
Is he a realist about universals, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear from this that he is. He's calling them things themselves.
Yeah, and if you are a realist about things themselves, then you think that not only... when I think the term cow in general, am I thinking of a bunch of different cows, but there is something over and above that, the universal cow that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, so concept, you're right, is not, it's a modern day way of referring to that, yes, as opposed to the idea, the Platonic idea that has to be involved, that seems to be involved for Augustine.
Right. It would, of course, be helpful, and maybe he did that in that other work, The Christian Doctrine, that I referred to talk about, you know, is there a universal cow or something? But all we can do is kind of read into what he says here, which, you know, he seems to have a problem with the notion of forgetfulness. There should be a universal that's a real thing, the thing itself that's referred to by forgetfulness. And that's the thing that would be a pure negative. Whereas for us, of course, forgetfulness is just a term we put together referring to all sorts of individual acts where we and people we knew forgot things. There's nothing problematic about it at all.
Yeah, I don't see the paradox even if we're Platonists, though. Can someone explain that to me?
Maybe we should read some more quotes. That-
well, this is just the beginning of 16, right?
Yeah.
I can also name forgetfulness and know what I mean by the word, but how should I recognize the thing itself unless I remembered it? I'm not speaking of the sound of the word, but of the thing that the sound signifies. For if I had forgotten the thing, I should be unable to remember what the sound stood for. When I remember memory, my memory itself is present to itself by itself. But when I remember forgetfulness, then memory and forgetfulness are present together. Forgetfulness which I remember, memory by which I remember. But what is forgetfulness except for absence of memory? How then can that be present for me to remember, which when it is present means that I cannot remember? At this point, I'm sort of feeling the way Mark did, that it seems like he's being way too literal about what forgetfulness is.
Well, yeah, if we can remember sorrow while feeling joy, why can't we remember forgetfulness without being forgetful, right? Clearly, he's being very Platonic here about it being a thing itself, and it sounds like, as well, if we just come into sort of intellectual contact with this thing, it's like it should sort of sap all the memories out of our mind because it's the ideal of forgetfulness or something. But
the footnote after the absence of memory, forgetfulness falls into that shadowy category of reality whereby something has its existence or is known by virtue of what it is not. See also Augustine's Breakthrough into Understanding of Evil, Darkness, and Silence. The recognition of such paradoxically unreal entities also opens the mind to even greater phenomena, such as the mind's participation in the intelligibility of God. Well, we don't have to care about what that last part means, but that's why I thought this was so important and why this psychology is supposed to be connected to metaphysics here. It's not just that I'm remembering now, but I can remember times in the past when I've forgotten, but that we are encountering an entity, but it's an entity that somehow doesn't have reality. And there seem to be all sorts of entities that, you know, evil itself has to end up being something that can't have reality. If it had reality, right, then it would have been created by God, but God didn't make evil. So it must just be something in our minds. It's a privation. It's a lack of something that we expect to be there or something, you know, it's just the absence of good.
So it's not a being except insofar as it's the absence of something else.
From a particular human perspective, because the universe as a whole has no such absence. It's a perspectively based absence, or I don't know, is it something that's only in the human imagination, like time?
I mean, I thought the point was that evil or forgetfulness or silence don't have their own existence. In particular, they don't have their own forms, if I would speak platonically.
Right.
But we speak of them only insofar as something is absent. So silence is the absence of sound, but there would be no form of silence. And the important one there is evil, which metaphysically, as Mark pointed out, becomes the avenue by which you are able to preserve the universal goodness of the world, but articulate what is meant by evil and have it, in some sense, be a real thing. So on the one hand, evil, quote unquote, doesn't exist. But on the other hand, evil is absolutely real in those terms, right?
Maybe in Kantian language, it's empirically real, but transcendentally ideal.
Oh.
But seriously, because it can't be real in the full sense for Augustine. It can't be
reality. Yeah,
so he would deny that. But
I shouldn't have said absolutely real.
That's why I was bringing in perspectival, the whole perspectival thing where, yes, it's real. Someone who's having their leg sawed off or whatever you think of as evil.
But is it perspectival, though? Because I thought that for Augustine, it's not a question of perspectivalness.
Well, this is the other part of his theory, that this absence, from a bird's eye point of view, there is no such absence. God would never look at the universe and experience such absence. It's just because we are sort of parts of the whole that we can experience such terrible things. There's no denying the terrible suffering in life and all the horrible things that can happen, whatever your metaphysical theory about it being an absence, right? There's more to his theory than that. He needs more than just to say, well, the evil isn't a metaphysical entity, it's just an absence, because you still have to explain away the psychological part of this. And the way I think that's done is it's this idea of our limited perspectives of the universe as opposed to God's bird's eye view. And God has the truth with a capital T, and we have something less. Unless we're totally into God, then everything's fine, no matter what happens to you. Anyway, this is sort of off. It's not in this particular reading. So,
well, it's one of the leftover things from book 3 and book 7, where he's talking about what evil is. And it's all very much connected with this idea of degrees of reality. So I was trying to remember whether Augustine was before or after St. Anselm of Canterbury, who has the ontological argument that talks about degrees of reality. And that's actually way later. That's like 600 years later. But you can see the roots, and I'm sure that it goes back to Aristotle or Plato and other folks like that, this idea that only God is completely real. That has everything to do with the fact that God is eternal, that if something is temporary, then it doesn't have true reality. And so there has to be some connection between that, why we are not truly real, and going down the gradations. So the most real thing is the creator. And then the creatures, the created things, still have reality. And insofar as they have reality, they are good. But below those, things that are not actually good have no reality. And so human beings, they have to have enough reality to be corruptible, but they can't have so much reality that they... Well, actually, the corruptibility is a good way of pointing at the middle point.
We're talking about being, nothingness, and becoming here.
Yep.
And it gets tricky real quick.
And I think that's entirely relevant to this talking about the rest of memory for the rest of this chapter as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's get into that. Or rather, we will get into that next time with part 2. Or you can get the whole thing right now by becoming a partially examined life citizen. And now Nathan is going to give you the Not School update. Bye-bye for now.
Hey everyone, this is Nathan Hanks with your weekly update from the Partially Examined Life's Not School. We're near the end of August now, so go check out the Citizens Forum to see newly proposed groups or to propose one of your own. Members are looking to discuss already The Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant, Anaheim, Returning to God After God by Richard Kearney, and even the entire philosophical canon starting from the beginning at Plato and working forward via text. That's an ongoing group. There are also several confirmed groups going to discuss Homo Sacer by Giorgio Agamben, that's on August 30th, The Fall by Albert Camus, also August 30th, The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, September 13th, and The Irony of American History by Reinhold Niebuhr, later in September. Now, I know there's something you've been wanting to discuss, and now's the time to get together with other PEL listeners for a conversation in September. Remember, groups don't have to be about books. You could watch a movie or a lecture series or play a video game. Anything goes. So just propose it in the Citizens Forum and see who's interested. And don't forget the after show covering episodes 121 and 122 on Augustine. It'll take place on Sunday, September 6th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Any PEL listener can catch it later or watch it live. And you can find out more about Not School and the other benefits of PEL citizenship at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Any questions, email me. That's Nathan@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks for listening and happy reading.